Welcome to The Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast with intro music where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cadle, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California. That's quite the beat. That's really good, Zach.
We bring, this is a high quality podcast. I'm Zach Paris. I am the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
And today we have a guest with us. A guest we're really excited to welcome, Aaron Tidwell. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here. And actually, I beg to be on this again.
So. Yes. We're so excited to have you. Aaron is going to be guest preaching for me on June 19th. And so we've invited him on the podcast to talk about those texts he'll be preaching on. He's really excited about them. But we'll get to that in a moment. Wanted to talk about, how about, just by way of introduction, Aaron, what are you up to these days? How did you come to be guest preaching in churches all summer long? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
And my name's Aaron Tidwell, and I have been, at least in my adult life, I've been an adult life Lutheran. I grew up Baptist. And somehow got into the Lutheran Church. I have no idea how. I know how. I went to Valparaiso University. That's how. Yay! And I was in youth ministry for many, many, many years. And now one of the things I love that I'm doing is I'm coaching track and field at Warren High School in Downey, California. And before COVID, I preached some, you know, I would just guest preach a lot. But right now with COVID kind of balancing out, I can't say ending, I'm being called a lot, especially this summer. And I'm preaching 3 to 4 weeks out of June, July, and August. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm excited because it's great to be back. I can't stay in the pulpit because I preach from the floor. But again, being in the Southwest California Synod, I'm having a lot of fun reconnecting with people and actually meeting people for the first time in some areas that I just thought I knew all the churches here in Southern California, but I'm finding out I don't. So that's who I am, I think, and what I'm doing.
Awesome. We're really glad to have you. Yeah, a fellow Valpo alum. We are no longer the Crusaders, Aaron. We're no longer the Crusaders. Finally, have dropped
and
that.
What are we now?
We're the Beacons. Doesn't that instill fear into the hearts of our basketball opponents, the Beacons?
Okay, so I don't think there's a lighthouse in Valpo. Just saying.
in luce tua vidimus lucem, in thy light we see light. I mean, just, you know, what was the alternative that was seemed to be pretty popular was Dune Hawks, which I guess was I'm not sure if that's a real animal, but it was named for the Indiana Dunes, the Dune Hawks, which did have a nice ring to it. It did at least seem like it was a creature that could take the floor. I don't know how you have a mascot for Beacon. It is a little challenging. It makes me think it's going to be like the Stanford Cardinal, where it's just like a tree, which is kind of like a lighthouse running around. But anything's better than Crusaders. So,
and I'm one who, until the discussion came about, I never even thought about the Crusaders. You know, it was just what it is. And so I was one who was like, oh, had my eyes opened because of it. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be preaching for us, Aaron, on a really kind of a big Sunday in many ways. So there's a couple of things happening this Sunday. It's Father's Day. So how to think about that? I mean, in my congregation, I know we observe Mother's Day and Father's Day. Mother's Day tends to be quite a bit bigger in my congregation, but we do still do Father's Day. Gosh, I mean, who doesn't love? Zach likes to talk about this being the dad cast sometimes, and now we have three dads on here today. This is really the dad cast.
Dads and grads.
Dads and grads. I've been thinking about dads lately because, Zach, I don't know if you're familiar with the television program Bluey.
Oh, I'm familiar.
Yeah, we've just discovered it in the last week.
Here. Really?
Here, I know.
Comes from all down under.
We never watched it before. So this show, they're like these little 8-minute episodes. And I have no idea what it was. And this little, I guess, like small child, these two little kids, they tend to play, they do these imaginative games, usually with their dad, right? The dad is like, I think on this show more than the other. And all I can think watching this show, like as one episode after another, is there's no way I can live up to this dad. Like he just seems to have just endless patience and just constantly like, oh, you guys want to play an imaginative game? There'll be like a sport, like what are they playing? Like Australian rugby or something? Like, and he'll want to watch it. And they'll be like, nope, gotta give it up. Gotta play with these kids. Like, and he's just so enthusiastic, endless patience. I'm like, this guy's incredible. Like, I can't. This is such a high bar.
Matt, the main takeaway, Bluey, is a reminder that you will never measure up to an anthropomorphic dog from Australia.
Right?
It does. And it becomes very annoying, Matt, if I can complain on the Dadcast, because my kid, my daughter loves Bluey, and just like in the same way the Bluey kids do it to their dad, right? Like, we'll just demand suddenly that we play an imaginative game, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like it's a dance party right now, and you're like, I can't, no, we're getting in the car, we're going to school, right? You need to like do these things, right? And you're right, Matt. You're right. Bluey, who is the actual Bluey? Bluey is not the dad, right?
No, Bluey's the kid. It's Bluey. Well, they tell you at every episode. There's a little intro where they do the dance party. They go, Mom, and then Dad, and then Bingo is the little sister, I guess, and then Bluey. Yeah. The dad's name is Bandit. I did do a Wikipedia deep dive.
I enjoyed, Matt. I don't know if you've gone into this particular rabbit hole.
Sorry, Aaron. This is our typical.
That posits, there's like a YouTube video, or maybe it's TikTok, about that Bingo and Bluey's family must be involved in some sort of illicit criminal organization, because like they like figure out like it's a real like the background, it's like a real city in Australia, and they're like able to figure out what neighborhood they live in, and the home prices are insane in that neighborhood. Right, like, and he, you know, as you know, like he's never working or anything, you know, and yet they can afford.
Yeah, that is, as a recent home buyer, I do also think that's a really nice house, like just all the time. Oh, well, I also want to say about Father's Day. So in my congregation, just like practically speaking, what does this look like? So historically at St. Mark's, it would be that the men prepared fellowship for the women on Mother's Day. And then on Father's Day, the women prepared fellowship for the men. Now, that's a little bit out of balance, because typically the women would prepare fellowship most of the year. Anyway, that's how folks would talk about it, right? Like the men do it for the women on Mother's Day. So this actually became a whole thing, because we didn't have much of a fellowship this year. It's our first Mother's Day back in person in several years. But it became a big thing because, and what I learned after doing some more listening about it was, this was a day when women in the congregation felt honored, right? And felt like somebody did something for them. And that was an important thing. I was like, okay, that makes sense. Like, let's think about how can we bring that forward? But one of the challenges I think that we're now living into, part of the challenge is that our gender numbers are out of balance. We only have a couple of like pretty consistent active men in the congregation versus probably a lot more women involved, but also that the younger generations aren't looking at gender in the same binary ways. And so the kind of like women prepare for men prepare for women, like meanwhile, in the month of June, we're preaching about, you know, gender as a spectrum and trying to talk through like, what does it look like to think about this in non-binary ways? And then we get to these kinds of holidays and we go, what do we do? One of my young adults had a really great suggestion that went on for Mother's Day. She said, well, what if we thought about this less in terms of gender and more about generation, where it was the younger generations honoring the older generation? I thought that's a really great like shift. It's one of my young adults to shift from gender to generation. That's really nice. But still, I think raises the question as we move into Father's Day, like, how do we think about this in a non-binary world, you know? And I don't have an extra answer to that, but I pose it to you all. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Uh-huh. First of all, if I could share my thoughts just on Father's Day in general,
for sure,
versus Mother's Day. You know, when I was a kid growing up, Mother's Day was this glamorous thing, flowers, presents, you know, mom got everything, you know, just did everything for her, and maybe we cooked for her too. Father's Day comes around, and back in those days, you got high karate and soap on a rope. That's what dad got, and that was it.
Soap on a rope!
And, you know, again, and as Zach said, you know, it's thrown in with grads. So Father's Day just always to me has been unbalanced when it looks at Mother's Day. But I also have issues with the whole, you know, father role versus mother role, being that I remember and my kids are in their 20s now, almost, one is almost 30. But you know, taking the kids to the park and, you know, having people come up to me, ladies come up to me and say, oh, it's so good that you're babysitting your children and giving your wife a break. I'm like, wait, these are my children. I would never say this out loud, but these are my children. I'm not baby. I'm taking care of my children. This is what I do. And so in society, we do that. You know, the dad's supposed to be away working, you know, 10 hours a day and then come home. And the wife's supposed to feed him. It's like, and we've never fit into that role, and I never liked that role. And so, you know, as we approach, you know, Mother's Day and then leading into Father's Day, it's like, I'm like your young adult. It's like, wait, this doesn't work for me in those levels. How do we do it? And I think fathers should be honored. I think mothers should be honored, but I think everybody should be honored, you know, and maybe at different times. And how we do it, I don't know. Because I've worked in congregations where, you know, the moms would get the flower, you know. So if you're a mom, stand up and we'll give you flowers. Like, ooh, what about that mom who's lost a child? Or, and so it becomes kind of tough. So I'm not sure I feel totally about it. But I do have things like you. I need to talk more. I want to know, you know, what's up. Those of you who want to keep the tradition as it has been, it's like, why are we doing it? So
Father's Day, Matt, according to Wikipedia, which is a reliable narrator for certain, is a responsive holiday. I'd never even considered, you know, I think I've seen on the internet before, that Mother's Day had to do with, you know, the Civil War and like that sort of stuff. So I wondered, right, is there a similar history? And no, in 1908, Matt, Grace Golden Clayton proposed the day to honor, where is it? Nope, here you go. 1909, Sonora Smart Dodd, after attending a Mother's Day at a church, convinced the Spokane Ministerial Association to celebrate Father's Day worldwide. So it's like a response to Mother's Day, which is kind of weird. So there you go. Fortunately, in my context, Mother's Day and Father's Day are not particularly important.
Not in campus ministry?
Festivals, yeah. We don't have a lot of programming going on at this time of year, so not huge for us.
I think part of what you said, Aaron, I think really puts a point on it, right? That like, it's like so many of these things, to be aware of the people in your congregation. It's kind of like that thing Jesus says where like, the Sabbath was created for you, not the other way around. And so like, how do we make sure in the midst of these days that we are honoring the people that are in the community, especially those folks that maybe don't get honored all the time. And sometimes that's fathers, sometimes that's mothers, mm-hmm. but, you know, making sure that we're honoring those folks who aren't always seen, but then also kind of pushing the boundaries of that a little bit beyond how we normally think about it. And sometimes that's the church's role, is to push those boundaries a little bit. So yeah, there's Father's Day, but it's not just Father's Day this year. Father's Day lands on June. Yeah.
I've got one important note before we move on to the really important stuff here. Okay. I've done the research, and I'd like to present to you the Bluey conspiracy theory.
We're back to Bluey.
Yeah. So they do live in a house in Brisbane in a neighborhood where the average home cost is $1 million, right? And Bingo, do you remember his profession? $1 million.
That's, I mean, that's Los Angeles. That's basically LA. Yeah.
Okay. I know. Still, do you recall his profession, Matt?
Isn't he an archaeologist?
He's an archaeologist. And the mom in Bluey, do you recall what she does?
Ooh, I'm not sure. I can't remember.
She works in airport security.
Oh, right? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So if you do the math, it's pretty difficult to afford a $1 million home with those two salaries. And perhaps you could say to yourself, well, maybe they have inherited wealth, right? Maybe they're independently wealthy. Or Matt, perhaps what's going on in Bluey is Bingo and his and the mom are working together to sell rare artifacts on the black market and move them around the globe.
Oh no!
Think about it, Matt. It belongs in a private collection. That's why he's like the
Indiana Jones,
upside down Indiana Jones. But now we can talk about important things.
Now that we've covered Bluey, amazing stuff. This is what they come to the vinyl preacher for. You don't get this on from Luther Seminary. Just
no.
Point it out. Well, this year, Father's Day lands on June 19th, also known as Juneteenth. So Juneteenth commemorates the day that the Emancipation Proclamation finally made it to Texas. And folks were set free there. I find it interesting. It seems to me that Juneteenth is something that has been celebrated really strongly in some places and less so in others, but in recent years has been growing quite a bit. And I'm sort of curious about that. So Aaron, do you have, since you'll be preaching on this day, do you have thoughts about Juneteenth? What's your history of thinking about this day?
As a kid myself, never heard of Juneteenth. I don't remember celebrating or even talking about it. They were very American. I don't remember any celebrations. I mean, we celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday. But other than that, any general ones that, you know, that would be centered around African Americans weren't there. Kwanzaa started when I was probably 7 or 8. And I remember going to a couple of Kwanzaa celebrations. And then Juneteenth is something I just heard of probably in the last 15, 20 years, you know, just in the background, and now it's coming to the forefront. I've always had, you know, issues with the way we celebrate some things, and especially the way, you know, Africans were imported to this country, brought over, and then, you know, and the worst this year was in Walmart. We had some kind of Walmart ice cream that was Juneteenth. I'm like, wait, first of all, what are you, as Walmart, what are you celebrating? You're celebrating that you let the people that you captured and brought over to this country and put in breeding farms and had them do all the work. And you're celebrating that, oh, we let them go. And so, and that's always been a tough thing for me. So how do we, as Americans, all celebrate it, and not, if we celebrate it, we also have to look at why it happened, you know, why is Juneteenth important? And we have to look back at the history. And if people want to say that's critical race theory or whatever they want to call it, we have to look at the realness of it. And then one thing I was reading is like, once they let the enslaved people go, they were encouraged to stay where they were because they weren't being given anything. You know, it's like, oh, well, you're free, but you should stay where you are and they're going to pay you a wage or whatever it is for doing the same thing that you're doing. And so, yes, celebration in the sense that now we are free, but also let's look at the real history and say, oh, wait. To a people at all, but it's happened to us in our history, and if we're going to celebrate it, let's also put into the context where it took us, you know, from one side, not even to complete to the other side, because yes, you're free, but you're really not.
Yeah.
And so I'm all for celebrations, but also let's look at it critically and study it and find out what we can do to bring us together. To make everybody, you know, as American if we want to say it that way, as American as we all can be, without saying that you have to be just like us when you come here. I do the history of it, because I learned that that's what we're going to talk about, I looked at the history, and it's fascinating history. But also, I want to really look at it and examine and talk about what that history is, not just to fall back and say, oh, let's just celebrate, let's have a barbecue. It's an extra day to have a barbecue, and let's go out and spend time with friends and family. Yes, let's do that. But also, what can we do to make this better for everyone?
Yeah, it seems like it's such a struggle for some folks in this country to think about history as complex, to think about present day reality as complex, you know, that we can be both free and not free. I mean, how to even think about, like, just to have room for complexity can be really a challenge. It seems to me like, I mean, just listening to some of what you were saying, like with your own experience that, maybe part of the reason for the growth in this observance is like a need for more holidays that are more reflective of our population in this country, of communities in this country, the need for more African-American holidays just in general. But then also this kind of ongoing struggle over how to tell American history, right? That like, what is Independence Day July 4th? Is Independence Day June 19th? Like, how do we think about this country and like leave room for complexity? And that is definitely a live issue. You know, there were moments when I thought, oh, we're finally like moving to a new, nope, we're dragged right back into. So yeah, it's an interesting moment to talk about it for sure. Zach, do you all talk about Juneteenth in your context? Or have you historically?
You know, again, June is a very low program time of year for us. So stuff that happens in June, you know, June is Pride Month, right? And so, which is a difficult time for us to like engage on campus because people aren't here and like there's Pride stuff happening in town, but students aren't really in town right now. So it's hard for us to engage that. I think that it does seem like the kind of emergence of Juneteenth in the conversation is a part of, you know, Matt, there are so many like ebbs and flows in the, you know, it's not a straight line towards a better world. But it does seem like there is, Juneteenth along with, you know, I'm thinking about like the increased awareness of like the Tulsa, like race riots, the Tulsa riots, that there does seem to be an increased awareness of all of these other, the picture is getting a little more, there's a little more detail growing, I think, in some of the public imagination in the public conception of what history is and what it looks like and our reality looks like. You know, similarly, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, so Juneteenth wasn't a big part of I didn't learn about Juneteenth like in school and stuff, right? We learned pretty intimately, you know, stories like the diner, the sit-in in Greensboro, and a lot of those more local things. But it seems to be a part of that broader movement, right? So like from my North Carolina perspective, right? To it's along the lines of like, yeah, sure, we, you know, it was a part of my public school education to learn about like the 60s civil rights movement, and that you know, my elementary school was the old segregated high school, like that they turned into an elementary school, and that was a part of an immersive part of our reality. And there's much that we learned about, but you know, the riots that happened in or the violence, whatever, in Wilmington, North Carolina, is not a thing I've learned about until, you know, recent years. And so perhaps, you know, on this podcast, we're pretty committed to the idea that things are typically pretty complicated and but worth digging into. You know, I'm not sure the Walton family should be leading conversations about about race and racial justice. But, you know, there are people, yeah. I'm not sure that corporations in general should be leading any conversations, but at least helpful, I think, that the picture is getting broader and more detailed.
Yeah.
Having the conversations, especially, you know, with people wanting to throw out critical race theory, the great thing is now people are looking back and saying, oh, what's critical race theory? And some people are really asking the questions. And so the discussions begin with that. As long as we are willing to, I think, open up our minds to the real history of the United States of America, I think it's very important. And one of the things that I think in a controversial sense for me is I want them to start singing all three verses of the Star Spangled Banner.
Tell us about that. What are the three verses?
All right. Because I don't remember the third verse, but it's the traditional is the two verses that we sing. And the third one is Francis Scott Key's reply to the free former slaves who were fighting for the British at that point. And he wanted to have them killed. They should be killed and done away with as much. And again, I apologize for bringing it up without knowing the exact words, but I think if we look back at that third verse, I don't know if you guys can pull it up on your computers. I don't have a separate computer, but Francis Scott Key was very much against freeing enslaved people. And so he was very upset about that. So.
Yeah. We really should drop that as the national anthem.
Yeah, no, this is not a good verse. Not a good verse.
Right.
That the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the Star Spangled Banner did triumph, doth wave, or the land of the free. There's some discord in the home of the brave.
Wow. You know, if you're going to teach stuff, if you're going to sing stuff, you need to know the full story behind it and not just leave out a verse because, oh, well, this doesn't apply anymore. Well, that was part of the whole song. And so how do you bring that together? So it becomes a thing for discussion. If that's going to be our national anthem, that's fine. But know the history. Know the full story.
As a Woody Guthrie approved podcast, we agree with that here because we enjoy the verses we leave out of This Land Is Your Land that imply that private property is not a legitimate concept. I wonder too, maybe if the thing that's helpful to think about, like, you know, just a reflection and learning in recent years, a thing that perhaps is helpful about Juneteenth is that as we tell more honest stories as a society about the history of the United States and race, there are areas where we like to, like, there's stories we like to tell, right? That, we like to tell the stories of the 50s and 60s because those are pretty romantic and can be pretty feel good stories about progress happening. And we, you know, gosh, people love some people just love the Civil War. And you can romanticize part of that. But I think, you know, the most undertold and important, like, story is, like, the absolute failure of Reconstruction is not a story about race that gets told very often. And you know, you alluded to it, Aaron, right? Like, that we just skip from, well, everybody was free, and then this Jim Crow thing happened. And there's a whole lot, almost 100 years in between there. And it's a very particular, like, failing of the United States. And not a story that gets told well enough about how it fails, and there's a lot more to it than just, you know, the 40 acres and a mule, broken promise sort of thing.
As we talk about these things on this podcast, it has me thinking about the role of the church in telling some of these stories. Right, we've seen this year. I mean, I took a trip to Florida a few months ago, which really had me taking a look at what Florida's been up to, passing laws around education and what you can and cannot talk about. And I think folks do that to get ahead in their own political careers. And it's really gross. But one of the, you know, as a church, we're not beholden to those rules, you know, and there are places where, like, we don't need to wait for the rest of the educational system to catch up in telling those stories. We have the freedom to do that within these communities. And that's a role that the Black church in particular has always played, right? Telling a different story in the midst of this larger American story. And that continues today in my context at St. Mark's. I know it's always really important for us. During Black History Month, there are a few leaders here that usually take the lead in saying, like, nope, we're going to tell the story of, you know, this year the theme is going to be athletics, and we'll tell the story of some Olympians, or this year it's going to be politicians, and we'll tell the story of some, particularly some of our women leaders like Kamala Harris or Karen Bass, and we'll tell some of these stories in the midst of worship, right? But it's this important thing. And so as Juneteenth grew in popularity just these last few years, our church got on board. We were worshiping online the last 2 years, but we found, I'll say especially Denise, one of the leaders here, found YouTube videos, and she said, we're going to play this at the beginning, and we're going to do this song, and we're going to tell this story. And we do that in the midst of church, right? This is one, I do think that's a role the church can play. It's one way, I think, to be prophetic, is to tell these stories, to not wait for the rest of the culture to catch up, but to begin telling them here and now, so that, you know, our children learn these stories and our adults have a chance to think about them in different ways. In the same way that we would teach scripture, like, you know, you're going to learn that story in Noah's Ark, and it's a fun story about animals. And so maybe when you're a kid, Juneteenth, this is a story about freedom, and it's great. And then as you grow older, you go, oh, wow, this is super complex, and you learn more. But every stage is important, right? We have to keep telling the story in all these ways. So sorry, I'm talking a lot, but I just, that role, the role of the church in all this seems important.
It's important. And again, I grew up in the Black church, and so things were highlighted that weren't, and especially coming in, I kind of started to come into my own after the major civil rights era. But again, even in church, we would talk about, you know, how to be safe, and, you know, especially as a young Black man, how to be safe and what not to do. And even to this day, there are things that I've learned even in the last few years that I just don't do. And it becomes a thing where the police, and I've had very few times when I've really dealt with the police on that professional level. But, you know, I know to keep my hands on the wheel when I'm stopped. And my thing is, I had one officer, this was 3 or 4 years ago, kind of laugh at me because I was very loud about what I was doing in the car when he asked for license and registration. So I just said, and I would say, okay, I'm going to let the window, I'm yelling this, I'm going to let the window down, take my finger up, I point it down to lower the window. And after I did a couple things like that, I mean, he was just laughing out loud. But again, it's things that you have to be aware of, because you don't want to put yourself in a situation where it's going to be somebody's life is going to feel threatened. And that's the history of our country, and we need to face up to it in a sense, and also be aware that, you know, as people see me, even as a 60-year-old Black man, sometimes it's like I still am a threat to them, and I don't understand that. And that's that history that I take with me in each and every setting, and being a part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America becomes difficult sometimes, because again, we have numbers. We want to look at numbers. We want 10% of this, you know, African Americans participating in all this. Well, it makes it very difficult for me when I walk in and say, "Oh, you know, Aaron, we'd like for you to be a part of this board." You know, it's like I'm not a board kind of person, you know, but you know, I keep getting asked, and not because of who I am and what I do, but because it feels like the skin, you know, my mm-hmm. skin. Those are the discussions that we need to have. And again, the church needs to have those discussions and be honest about it and say, and if you want to be a welcoming thing, and this is my thing. If you want to be welcoming to people, don't come in and say, come on in, everything's ready for you. You know, invite them in and say, hey, why don't you help? You can help setting the table. You know, and so when we talk about that and then bring in all of who you, what and who you are, to join with us, and then we'll make this for all of us together. Does that make sense? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really helpful. I'm going to be chewing on that for a while. Don't say everything's ready, but here's here's a role. Here's something that you, would you do this? Would you participate in this way? That's really, yeah. Thank you for that. Well, you know, as we think about complexity, free and not free at the same time, good news and not good news at the same time, our scriptures sometimes are the same way. And so to get these scriptures on this day, I don't know, what are you up to? What are you up to, God? What are you up to, lectionary committee? I don't know. We'll see. Let's dive in. Let's see what they are. There are a good, I'll say this. I don't know if we'll find good news, but we will find some good stories, I think. So here's what we've got. 1 Kings chapter 19. We're diving in. It looks like semi-continuous readings for this summer are the prophets. And so here's a story about Elijah. Here we go. Ahab, we're just jumping in media res right away. No flashbacks. You know, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Oh, this is a summer blockbuster for you right here. Then he was afraid. He got up and he fled for his life and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree, and he asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." And then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." And he looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And so he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." And so he got up and ate and drank. And then he went in the strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights. To Horeb, the Mount of God. And at that place he came to a cave and spent the night there. And then the word of the Lord came to him saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." And he said, "Now go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered again, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." And then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus." Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God. What do you think? Any thoughts, reactions?
I love it, Matt. I love it. What a beautiful and true story of discernment, right? I mean, there's so much fantastic stuff going on here. you know, I've gotten to kind of opt out of a lot of our conversations so far because we don't do much in June, so I don't have a lot of interesting practical ideas. But one thing we do a lot of is discernment and vocation type talk. And people want to know, right? The question that so many of us engage God in the world with is, what am I supposed to be doing, right? If I would just have some clarity around what it is I'm supposed to do with my life. And oftentimes our visions for what that looks like, it'd be really nice, right? If God came in a great wind that was so strong that it was splitting mountains in half and breaking rocks, we want it to be big and dramatic and clear, right? But I love this. I mean, gosh, I love this one, right? But the Lord was not in the wind. It doesn't even tell you how you knew, how they knew that, like, just,
yeah,
they just knew the Lord was not in the wind, right? And then there was an earthquake. Oh, gosh, that's great sign. Thank you for a sign, God. I've been asking for a sign. Here we've got one. And then there was a fire, but then the Lord was not in the fire. The Lord was not in the earthquake. Then there's the sheer sound of a sheer silence, which sometimes we romanticize into like a big, like, I've heard plenty of people talk about, you know, like, I remember I was at a conference and I found this unconvincing. This person was explaining how their call like came and they're like, I was praying in church and it was quiet. And I just heard a voice and a voice said, preach. And that sounds great, but I haven't had that experience, right? And that's not a dependable like source, right? You know, like if that happened for you and that I don't want to be a complete jerk, right? Like that's great if that works for you. But that's not like, that's a really hard place to get to, right? Like it puts God on top of the mountain, you know, like we got to go climb up the mountain to find God, right? Where this, our Lutheran perspective is that God comes to us in these, not just in these like life-changing, really transformative, really transfiguration-y sort of like events, but in these like quiet, perhaps not just like silent, right? But these quiet parts of life, these normal, boring, everyday things. And so that for me, as I flip it into good news, right? I think that's really good news because it means I don't have to climb a mountain. I'm not waiting for God to like, for earthquakes and fire for me to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. But to continue, gosh, and I love it too. God doesn't even give a good answer, you know, right? Like, God, first of all, God's response is just questions, the same question twice, which has to be so annoying, right? What are you doing here, Elijah? And he's like, what? Blah, 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 blah. And then there's like, he's in a terrible, like, geological place, evidently. And then again, what are you doing here? And then it's just return to your way, continue walking on the path you've been walking on, head out through the wilderness there. And that's all you need to do. And so that, I mean, that's another piece of the good news too. The good news isn't like, if this was a movie, Aaron, Matt and I have been pitching ourselves to HBO for a while that they should do, we should write for like an HBO series, like where we dramatize the Bible and really lean into the HBO-ish sort of parts of things, you know, with the violence and sex and stuff. Cause we're kind of like experts at that stuff. But in the HBO series, right, this would normally go where like you'd be given like, here's the ring, you need to take it to Mordor, right? Like here's your giant quest, this impossible task you have to accomplish, that most people can't, right? But that this is just like, oh, just there's not even a destination, there's hardly a destination, right? Like the wilderness of Damascus is not like a place, right? Like just continue on your way, that's all you have to do. And I think that's good news for the students I interact with who feel the pressure of like, you know, these days, college, the students are more aware of it being an economic like endeavor, right? I got to make it worth it financially. I got to live into the expectations I have for myself and my family has for me about all that I'm going to accomplish. That I got to be like, you know, that the university talks about all the super successful people who went here. But there's not that pressure in this story, I don't think.
I mean, I agree with that. In my history, we're always, you get the other stories where it's like you said, you know, somebody's whispering in your ear, somebody's beating you over the head. This is what God wants you to do. And in the church setting that I grew up in, that's how it was done. You didn't get this mild thing. It's like, but God will speak to you. God will come to you at night and God will say to you very loudly so that you understand, you know, get out of here, go there. And then not having that experience and and I've worked in a church most of my adult life, but not having that experience, you know, I would always say, well, I don't feel called. You know, God never came to me and said this, or this Holy Spirit never came to me and, you know, opened my eyes in that sense, or Jesus didn't put mud on my eyes and open them up. So, you know, I was blind, now I can see. And I didn't, and so I felt, I guess, unworthy would be a thing, because I wasn't being called personally. And again, especially in the Lutheran church, there was, oh, excuse me, you know, Aaron, what have you been doing? You work with children, you do this, you do this. It's like, that's your call. It's like, but God didn't tell me, you know? And that's what I and even, you know, some part of me today is still asking that question. You know, I'm in, but it's still in my, it's still ingrained in me. And so in this verse changes that a little bit, but it's still going to be a part of me. But this verse says, you know, God says, just go back and do what you've been doing. I like that. So.
Yeah, those stories can look so different. I know folks ask me, you know, did you always know you want to be a pastor? And I go, nope. Absolutely not. Well, what was the moment? Well, there wasn't one single moment. It was a step-by-step journey. That was my story. Now, someone else might have a story where it's, yep, it was a flash of light. But those things take such different forms. And even here, like, it's not a formula, right? That, like, I mean, I think that line that you highlighted there, Zach, where it's, the Lord was not in the wind, not in the earthquake. You would think it would say, and after the fire, a sound of sheer silence, and the Lord was in the silence. But it actually doesn't say that. It just leaves it open, right, and mysterious. And that's much more true to life, that mysteriousness.
And if I'm forced to think about big moments that were moments of clarity and calling, most often I'm only able to really see those moments in upon reflection, mm-hmm. like looking back. Mm-hmm. You know, that one of the things that I've argued for over the years is helping people develop like language of call story and not to develop a singular call story. Cause there's this pressure in going through the seminary process where you have to tell your call story over and over again. And you're like working on one story, but that's not really how I don't find that's how life works. And that it's much more helpful if I have a bunch of call stories, cause that's more true, right? Like, and so like the one that I love to tell these days is, you know, I was a library assistant in elementary school, which was meant I had a lot of friends. That was pretty cool. I got to go to school early and stay late. a lot of people envied my position in life. But Lois Lowry's book, The Giver, came in and I got to read it first. Before it went to circulation, and it's about like giving memories and like receiving memories of this. So, and that's like I think upon like reflection, this turned out that was a really big moment. I see myself now living out a lot of what happened in that moment, and I didn't know that certainly at the time. The other thing, Matt, before we move too fast, quick here, especially with talking about Juneteenth. In the ELCA is that line where Elijah says, "I'm no better than my ancestors," which is woo. That'll punch you in the stomach. It reminds me of I heard it through Martin Marty, and I was Googling trying to figure out because Marty was probably borrowing from somebody else, where he talks about our ancestors, he has this thing where he says, you know, that there's here you go, Max Scheller. Three alases is what he talks about. When things are bad because of the evil in our heritage, Max counsels that we can say, oh, what did my ancestors do? As if you're like disgusted at your ancestors, right? And it's important to know that, but we can't change the past. Scheller's second one is, alas, what have I done? But that also refers to an unchangeable past. But the third one looks to the personal, to the present, to the future. Alas, what kind of person am I now that I know that I am capable of doing this as my ancestors did, which points us to the future. And I've always found that helpful. And especially as I've probably said it on the podcast, a nearly direct descendant of Samuel Parris, a notable witch burner in Salem, Massachusetts. I tell that story a lot because it's kind of funny because we don't think about which word you mean real, but also it is a reminder of the reality of who I am and who my ancestors are, and is a helpful reminder to know, to hear a calling that says, who am I and what should I do knowing that I'm capable of these things?
Yeah. Amen to that. I know we got to move on from this passage, but I'm just so...
It's too good.
I'm so attached to it. It's so good. The other thing I really love, I know we're like trying to move past the just dramatic moments in a call story, but there is something to this wilderness and Elijah being in this isolated, low place. And I'm so struck by that. And I think, you know, the connection...
That's the most relatable part of his call story is the part where he's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I give up. Like, just...
I find that so powerful this morning.
I was in a similar situation.
I think the connection to what we've been talking about is like, go to that place, right? Like the at the Festival of Homiletics a few weeks ago, Nadia Boltz-Weber talked about like when she reads a passage, like, yeah, her first reaction is, I got nothing every single time. And then she eventually finds like, what's that one part that really sticks in her heart? What's the one part that hurts? What's the one part that just really like, you can't, it just sticks there. And so like, go to that low place, even though it seems like it's hard. And I think that's here, this moment in the wilderness. And so the other thing I'll say about the wilderness is, I know Aaron's going to throw some Star Trek stuff at me, but if you've been watching Obi-Wan Kenobi, this is totally right here. He's in the desert. He's at a low place. He's isolated. They have lost to the Empire. Everything is lost. It's the end of the story. And he's at the entrance of the cave. Let's see what happens next. So just for you Star Wars fans out there, just a little Obi-Wan connection.
I don't have a Star Trek answer for you today. So
every time I post Star Wars on Facebook, Aaron goes, live long and prosper.
One time.
Matt, if I watch The Mandalorian, do I really need to watch Obi-Wan Kenobi?
It's so good. it's better than Boba Fett. I'll say that. All right, Galatians.
We're gonna do it, Matt. All right.
I don't know.
This is Paul's letter to Galatia. It's a quick one. Now, before faith came, we were imprisoned and guarded under the law until faith would be revealed. There, the law was our disciplinarian until Christ came, so that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, and we are no longer subject to a disciplinarian. For in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith. As many of you as were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male or female, for all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. The word of the Lord.
Yeah, it's a short one, and I don't want to go too deep on it just because the Luke story is just another really great, rich story. But I do think it's interesting as we're thinking about, there is no longer male and female. Happy Father's Day. I mean, we're thinking about moving beyond binaries. We're thinking about being free and not free at the same time. And so just that line of like, what does that mean? I mean, it sounds good. And I think it is good news, but there's also complexity to it, right? Like, how do we maintain our identities? But also be one in Christ Jesus. And I think that's a reality worth exploring too. I don't know. You all got anything else?
Yeah. If the church is about, like we said earlier, a part of the church's role in the world is to offer these competing, contrasting narratives with the narratives we're served. There's something important about the juxtaposition of proclaiming Happy Father's Day while we read out loud that there is no longer male or female.
Luke, the Holy Gospel according to Luke. Aaron, do you want to read this one? Do you have it in front of you?
I have it in front of me. I'm pulling it up. 26. Through 39, correct?
Yep,
that's it.
Okay, here it is. The NRSV version. Then they arrived at the region of the... Oh my gosh, this is reading Acts. then they arrived at the region of the Gerasenes. which is opposite Galilee. As he stepped out on shore, a man from the city who had demons met him. For a long time, he had not worn any clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him, shouting, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles. But he would, he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wilds. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. They begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. The hillside, a large herd of swine was feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd stampeded down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When the swineherds saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came out to see what had happened. And when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right and in his right mind. And they became frightened. Those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed. Then the whole throng of people of the surrounding region of the asked Jesus to leave them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." For he went away proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ. Thank you. What do you think? You were saying earlier, and you just love these texts. They're just... They're great. What's your initial reaction to this text? What do you think?
My initial reaction, because you guys are movie guys, I'm thinking I'm watching Alien.
Alien? Why does it make you think of Alien?
Well, because he was possessed, and you know the creature, the alien, got into the guy and possessed him, and he was not himself. And then in the end, you know, it wasn't the pigs running over into the water and drowning himself. It was that creature, the alien or the demon, you know, bursting out of the man and not going into the abyss, but going into the ship, running around and scaring everybody else.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
God, and I was like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love it, Alien.
And it becomes, I mean, it's a good ending. In that sense, but you still got people more afraid. They're not going out proclaiming Jesus. They're afraid. They're getting out, you know, it's like, oh, this is fear. And, you know, they send, you know, Jesus, get out of here kind of thing. So, but I like the end where, you know, Jesus says, well, you can come with, you know, don't come with me. You need to stay here and just proclaim what you have seen.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I love that. Is this the kind of text that you like to preach on, or is this the kind of text you'd be like, oh man?
Read it. You know, you sent it to me. I first read it. I was like, so this is why Matt's leaving town. It's not something. I think I'm still struggling with the whole demon possession type of thing. You know, even when it's mentioned in the Bible. And how's that work? Does that mean, you know, when you don't like what somebody's saying, does that make them a demon? You know, because their politics doesn't line up with mine. Is that a demon? You know, what makes them a demon? Is a demon the person who's hooked on some kind of drug that's out in the street, you know, who might be naked or just walking around? You know, how do you define that demonness?
Yeah.
And so that's one thing for me I struggle with. How do we name these things? And so, like when I first read it, you know, beyond being a funny struggle, it's a real struggle within me. How do you define this? How do you know who's evil, who's not? you know, and is because they're doing something you don't agree with, does that make them evil? And then are they possessed? So.
Yeah. No, that seems like such an important question. Like, how are we going to think about this demon possession? And not even just as like this abstract, you know, wondering, but especially in a moment in our culture, it feels like where we demonize each other so quickly. Like we figure out like this.
No, binary, we don't.
You know, no, we don't. So to ask that question though, like, well, how do we, what do we do about this? You know? Yeah, that's a really good question to ask.
Oh, Matt, to make some connections here for you, because I like maps, and there was something to map here. The region of the Gerasene, the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee, it's an area to the east of, it's a little south of the Sea of Galilee, but east of the Jordan, right? So if in the north, in the top of our biblical map, there's a Sea of Galilee, at the bottom is the Dead Sea, and the Jordan River connects those two bodies of water. And that all of the good stuff, quote unquote, good stuff, is on the western side of the river. Right? That's where Jerusalem is. It's where Galilee is. It's where Judea is. It's where all of the kind of home territory of the Jesus movement is. And so they are not there. I think that's the important thing to note with the region of the Gerasene. They are fairly east of the river. They're not along the riverbank. They're up actually at this other tributary of the river, Awadi. So they're pretty far away from like home base. And if you want to connect it to that first reading, that's the places, it's the kind of place that Elijah gets sent. Continue on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. Damascus, pretty far away, definitively not Judean. It's not a Jewish area, not a Galilean area. It is very far away. And so if you want to connect the pieces, Jesus and the disciples in this story are in the kinds of places that Elijah is called to, places that are uncomfortable, where things that appear demonic appear to be, and where the unexpected happens and things get flipped upside down. Right, because everybody gets afraid when Jesus heals and everybody's like, oh.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Jesus is upsetting the natural order of things.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I keep going back to the Festival of Homiletics because they talked about this passage a couple of times. And Otis Moss III, pastor at Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, one of my favorite preachers, gave a lecture on this passage. So I'm going to pass on some notes to you all, all of you listeners out there, because he has some really good stuff. He talked about how the beginning of this passage, and he interpreted the possession, you know, that one way to think about it is mental health, but instead of the people, instead of dealing with his mental health, just tried to incarcerate him. And that is such our response so often, is to just try to incarcerate. Instead of dealing with the root causes, we just throw incarceration at it, right? And we still do that. And so that's like, that is this reality at the start of this story. And then, of course, his name, when he says, what is your name? He says, Legion. And of course, a legion is a Roman battalion, right? We've talked about that a lot. But he also said that, you know, it's this move in saying Legion. It moves it beyond a personal, individualized struggle and into this public reality that he's being affected by a set of policies, by layers, legions of public neglect and exploitation. This is a public thing. And then with
So because you guys are pastors, so you know this.
Sure.
So what's from the, is Legion taken directly from the original translation? Is that the word, or have we changed it into something that made it more sense to us?
Zach, you're so much better at the Greek.
Oh, it is legion. L-E-G-I-O-N is the, which is how they spell it in English, is a transliteration of the Greek. It's straight from it. Which is, there is a division of the Roman army numbering about 6,000 infantry with additional cavalry, hence a very large number. It reminds me, Matt, I came up with I had an insight that I gained before I was incarcerated by a French nun when I was in Taizé.
You got to listen to the last episode and get that whole story.
Yeah, I got COVID in Taizé in a monastery and a French nun, you know, the most empathetic people on earth, French nuns, took care of me, for which I'm grateful for their care. And yet, still, we had to do Bible study every day, and one, I forgot what passage it was, but it was one where Jesus was saying some really harsh things about the religious officials. And in my kind of like insight learning from the day was Jesus almost never directly goes after the Romans, right? In any of his teachings, he goes really hard after the religious authorities. And in part, he does that because he can, right? That if he's in their area of sphere of influence, typically he'll go after him if he has the crowds with him who will protect him. Or he's somewhere else. He's outside, like he's where he is today, right, in the region of the Gerasene, where the temple officials don't have any power. Versus if Jesus went around saying the things that he says about the temple officials, about Roman authorities, the Gospels would not be very long because they would immediately put him to death. And so there's something very practical, I think, about Jesus, who Jesus goes after. And the point he's making, and that just makes me hear this story as this maybe is as close to Jesus comes to directly confronting the Roman Empire. And he does it still in a pretty like he kills. I mean, there's a reading of it where like if you're Roman and you're a Roman official, you can read this pretty easily where Jesus like destroys a legion of Roman soldiers. Jesus layers it a bit, right? They're not real soldiers. Jesus doesn't say this, right? The demons itself claim to be, but this story is pretty anti empire. Which again, Juneteenth, that's you know, there's plenty of good that the Roman Empire did. See the life of Brian, and yet folks had reason to critique it.
What a reference. I think the pigs play into that a little bit too. So, mm-hmm. again, just going off of OM3's commentary here, he asked this question. He said, what are pigs doing in Palestine? Like pigs are not going to be on mm-hmm. the menu in a Jewish context. Right? So what are these pigs doing in Palestine? And so he interprets this as like, there's this illicit trade going on. This has something to do with the Roman Empire and that Jesus is disrupting mm-hmm. this economy, right? Which is a different way of like in our country, like pigs, these poor pigs, like what are we doing? But this is actually like this.
There's
a lot going on with that. What are the pigs doing in Palestine? I think is a thread that might be worth pulling. But I think the most important thing, the thing that really stuck with me that he said is that piece about fear, right? That they are the time when they get afraid is at the end after he's in his right mind, which is really strange, right? The people are afraid because he is in his right mind. The people are afraid because he is free. And Otis Moss is speaking to a conference of preachers. And so he says this line, there is no greater fear in this nation than when preachers are in their right mind. I said, oh my gosh. So just to think about what does it mean to be in our right mind and why would these people be afraid of this man finally being in his right mind? What are we afraid of? As we think about that question, what are we afraid of? I was reading this book. It's called We Rise Higher. It's by Joe Davis, this Lutheran poet out of Minneapolis. It's We Rise Higher, Poems and Prayers for Graduates. And this one
Dads and grads.
Dads and grads, y'all. Dads and grads. If there's this one line stuck with me, if there's any fear at all, any fear that's true, it's the fear that you might really do what you came here to do. Joe Davis. So, what are we afraid of? Good question to ask.
I like it, man.
Well, Aaron, do we redeem the texts?
I mean, maybe not fully redeemed, but I can work with it now. So, right, and sometimes right. You just have to, yeah.
That's right. I know. Well, thanks for the conversation on it. Well, as you know, as we think about texts, we also make a playlist. So what are we going to be listening to as we sit with these texts? Zach, what do you got?
Oh, gosh. Matt, I did so much prep for this episode and have thought about a thousand songs. As you recall from last week's conversation, Matt, about Eurovision, I'd like to point you toward fantastic song called Jezebel. It was a Eurovision entry of I want to make sure I get this right, the Czech Republic. I don't know any other lyrics other than by the Rasmus, and it's it's Finland, actually. Zoma, my daughter, hated this song, and the only part I remember is that Jezebel, it was super Finland, like thrashy death metal sort of thing, but you know, you listen to it enough and it's pretty good, you like it. Then Matt, in honor of the Dave Matthews Band's continued sponsorship of Paul's Epistle on the podcast, I just learned that Dave, off of Before These Crowded Streets, have a song called Pig that fits, I think, fits this week. And then I'm going to throw one on. I really love that Otis Moss, Why They're Pigs, What Are Pigs Doing in Palestine? I love that kind of stuff. I feel like I did it like a month or two ago where I was like, hold on a second. Why is this happening? Because I love it when the Bible like presents you with this, like, here's the background. And you're just like, in upon first reading, we're always like, okay, that's what the background is. And then you could be like, wait, hold on a second. Why are the pigs here? I wish I was preaching this week. I'll be on vacation. It reminds me of when pigs fly is a part of what's going on here. So I'm going to put, it just made me think of the Tom Petty song, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers off of Wildflower. What is it called? I'll Be King. I know the lyric. The lyric goes, I'll be king when pigs fly, essentially.
When dogs get wings.
When dogs get wings. There you go.
There similar you go, sentiment. Thanks for, absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to throw on, how can I not? The Sound of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel.
It's good to be king.
Just is inspired by the story of Elijah. Florence and the Machine have a new album, finally. She's so good. She has a song in there called Free, and it's actually really good, and I think relevant. Check it out. And then finally, John Batiste, one of Chris's favorite artists from last year, album of the year, Freedom. Got to put Freedom on there. Just a classic song. That's what I got. Aaron, you got some songs for us?
I have some songs. And so first one I've got is by McFadden and Whitehead. So this dates me. So this is back in the 70s, and it's called Ain't No Stopping Us Now. And you can apply that to the pigs once they're driving off the thing. there's no stopping us now. We're going over, man. It's over. Because they didn't want to go into the abyss. So let's do this. And I guess that wasn't the abyss. I don't know. Next one, I Will Survive. And that goes with the, who was it? First lesson. Oh,
Elijah Kings.
Because he's in the wilderness and gets all this information, you know, but he will survive. He doesn't know quite what he's doing, but he knows he's going to survive, right? And the third one is because, if I may say this publicly out loud, I was at someone's house because they did a house blessing party. And it was a wonderful party. It was a great time, a lot of fun people. And that person had a playlist, and it's a beautiful playlist with lots of newer songs and some older songs, but that person did not put one Barry Manilow song on the list. I was a little upset. You know? And just for those people who don't know me, I am not kidding. I love my Barry Manilow. And so this is in honor of that person who will remain nameless. I don't want to call anybody out, who just bought a house.
Did you get some lemons out? Did you take any lemons home?
I didn't. Nobody offered me lemons. So no Barry Manilow offered me lemons. Yeah, I'm just saying. and it's so I do have a Barry Manilow song, and it's called One Voice. No, wait, is it One Voice? Yeah, One Voice. And one of the lyrics are just one voice singing in the darkness. All it takes is one voice singing so that you hear what's on your mind. And when you look around, you'll find there's more than one voice. So it's a Barry Manilow song. Beautiful. So if you get a chance, listen to that.
Amen. Amen. I like
that's
that.
That's my three.
Excellent. Excellent playlist. Way to include Barry Manilow. Good stuff. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's fun. It's been fun. So.
Awesome. Well, good up, Zach. Good up. It's been real.
Real vinyl.